Good morning. If you have your Bible with you, would you take it out now, please, and turn to Matthew chapter 26. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 26. It's a long chapter dealing with Christ and the events surrounding His betrayal and arrest and the beginning of His trials. But we'll look in verse 63 here in just a moment. Matthew chapter 26 and verse 63 is the first passage to which we will turn this morning. I want to begin this morning by just having you, if you would, step back to a week ago and call to mind everything we learned last week about covenants. And the covenants that we see God making with people at different times throughout the history of mankind. If you weren't here last week, what we did is we looked at five key passages in the Old Testament that tell the Old Testament story in terms of covenants, in terms of these solemn agreements that God made with His people. I'm going to put myself on the spot here, see if I can go through all five off the top of my head. Forgive me if I don't. The first one is Genesis chapter 3, right? And that first covenant God made between people. In the garden, and we see that Adam and Eve sin and break that covenant. The second passage is Genesis chapter 12, the promises and covenant that God made with Abraham, and we see that laid out in greater detail in Genesis chapter 17 as well. The third passage is that old covenant, the Mosaic covenant, seen especially in Exodus chapter 24, where they seal the covenant with blood and they have fellowship with God. They eat and drink with Him. The fourth passage is 2 Samuel 7 and the covenant that God makes with David, that He's going to make him a house, that He's going to establish His kingdom forever, and this will be a kingdom where sin does not rule. And then the final passage, the fifth one, Jeremiah 31, and that promise of a new covenant that's going to be greater and supersede and ultimately be the fulfillment of all of these other covenants that God has made with people. This new covenant that we choose to come into of our own free will. We're not born into it, but we choose to submit ourselves to God. Now, keeping in mind those five passages, everything that we talked about last week, and the importance of these covenants that God makes between us as people, and understanding that there are many, many more covenants that God makes throughout the Bible, I want to ask you a question. Very simply, it's this. Can Christians today swear an oath to the Lord? Now, some draw a sharp distinction between oaths and vows, and there's probably a slight difference, but for our purposes this morning, we'll use them interchangeably. Can a Christian today swear an oath or make a vow to the Lord? I think many Christians would probably say no to that on the basis of Matthew chapter 5, verses 33 through 37 that we'll read here in just a moment. But before we get there, I want us to think about a few things before reading Jesus' teaching there. We see in Matthew chapter 26, verses 63 and 64, that Jesus testified under an oath. Here He is being questioned by the Sanhedrin, and Jesus is kept silent. And in verse 63 it says, "But Jesus kept silent, and the high priest answered and said to him, 'I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God.'" Now keep in mind, Jesus has kept quiet all up to this point. "Then Jesus said to him, 'It is as you say. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven.'" Referring to Daniel 7 and Psalm 110 in these messianic passages. Jesus waits until this moment to respond. We might say He waited until He was under oath to say what it is, to answer what it was they were questioning. And maybe you could say that Jesus didn't really make an oath on this occasion. He just answered or testified under one. But we know that God made an oath by Himself in this new covenant. If you turn to Hebrews chapter 6, Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 13. Hebrews is a book that is really emphasizing that Jesus is better, that Christ is better, and that His covenant is better. And he's calling to mind this covenant that God made with Abraham. And he says in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 13, "For when God made a promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, 'Surely blessing, I will bless you, and multiplying, I will multiply you.' And so, after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promises. For men indeed swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is for them an end of all dispute. Thus God, determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath." Now certainly we understand that God in his character cannot and does not lie. And yet we see here God himself makes an oath, confirms it by an oath. And it says that he wants to confirm to them, wanted to show more abundantly the immutability of his counsel by confirming it by an oath, he says there in verse 17. This is the guarantee, we might say, that God is going to fulfill what it was that he said he was going to fulfill. Well, maybe you could say again, the rules are different for God. Perhaps, but don't we make oaths and vows in our day-to-day life? If you had to testify at a trial, for instance, and they bring out a Bible and they say, "Put your hand on the Bible and raise your right hand and repeat after me, 'I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God.'" That's swearing an oath to the Lord. Would you be willing to do that? If you had to take some public office, and perhaps someone in here has even done that, you have to raise your right hand and swear that you're going to properly go through all of these procedures, you're properly going to administer the things that you have right to administer according to the office that you're holding, would you be willing to do that? Have you done that? Under more simple terms, and again, this is perhaps not swearing an oath to the Lord, but it is a vow or an oath. Have you ever had to sign a contract to get a job or buy or sell a house or whatever? Even more, at your wedding, as we talked about last time, did you say, "I do"? Did you repeat vows, not just to your spouse, obviously, but to the Lord, as an initiation sign of your covenant? Did you, as my wife and I did, exchange rings as a sign of that covenant, a sign of remembrance of that covenant? What is that, if not a vow or oath to the Lord? In other words, a vow or an oath is the basis of a covenant. There is a solemn agreement being made. Even more, as we think about those covenant passages, when you were baptized into Christ, into this new covenant, you've made a commitment, haven't you? A vow or an oath of sorts. In being baptized into Christ, you've what? Put on Christ. You've put on His character. You're saying, "Who I was before, I am not anymore. I put off that old man of sin, and now I am Christ. I'm going to follow what it is He wants me to do." And so with all of that background, how then do we understand what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 33? You'll turn there with me. I went to all of these passages and all of this trouble first because of the weight of what it is that Jesus says here in this passage. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 33, beginning. Jesus is correcting all sorts of mistakes that they have made under the old covenant, and he is beginning to lay forth the parameters of his kingdom, of the new covenant. And he says in verse 33, "Again you have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but you shall perform your oaths to the Lord.' But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is His footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one." Well, that kind of settles it, doesn't it? Well, it does if we understand this in its proper context. What the scribes and Pharisees had done before the time of Jesus, but certainly by the first century, is that they had taken these Old Testament, Old Covenant passages that were intended to emphasize the need for truthfulness and reliability and fulfillment of oaths, and they had twisted them to mean that, hey, you can lie whenever you want to, as much as you desire, provided you don't take an oath by certain things. Now, Matthew himself gives us some insight into this if we turn to Matthew chapter 23. Matthew chapter 23 and verse 16. He's pronouncing woes on the scribes and Pharisees. And one of the woes he pronounces in verse 16 is this: "Woe to you blind guides who say, 'Whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obligated to perform it.' Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies by the gold? And here's something else they would say: 'Whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obligated to perform it.' Fools and blind, for what is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. And he who swears by the temple swears by it and him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God, by him who sits on it." And he goes on to pronounce some other woes on them as well. That's just kind of ridiculous, isn't it? And I believe this is the more that is from the evil one that Jesus is condemning in Matthew chapter 5. When you get right down to it, what was the problem that they had? The problem was they didn't want to tell the truth. That was the problem. And the Jews thought that if they could somehow avoid things directly tied to God in their oaths, we might say if they had enough degrees of separation, okay, you've got God, you've got the offering to God on the altar, and then you've got the altar. So that's 2 degrees of separation removed from God. And so if you swear by the altar, hey, it's okay. And you've got God, and then you've got the money that is dedicated to God, and then you've got the temple that houses the money, and so that's far enough away from God. If you make an oath by that, you don't have to keep it. It's really kind of silly. If they were to swear by something that was to the Lord, well, they had to perform it. But if they swear by something that was lesser, then they didn't. And what's ironic is that in the Old Testament, true sincere vows or oaths to God were a sign of faith. If I swore by the Lord truly and sincerely, that was saying I put my faith in God, that I go to God that He might be witness of these things that I have sworn to perform, that He is most important in my life and I can swear by no greater. That's the way it's portrayed in the Old Testament. And yet they had taken this solemn outpouring of faith. And what these scribes and Pharisees had done is basically turn it into a superstitious game, right? They're kind of like children. Oh, I promise that's exactly what I'll do. Ha ha, I don't have to do it because my fingers were crossed, right? And that's basically what the scribes and Pharisees had done. They said, here is the way you have to play the game. And never mind, yes, I will do that. No, you have to swear it. And you have to swear it by the right thing or you don't have to perform it. And so what Jesus does is He just kind of throws out their entire little made-up system, saying in essence, there is nothing by which they can swear that is not ultimately tied to God and His power and His ownership. Even the hairs of your own head you do not control. They are controlled by God. And so anything you swear by is ultimately swearing by God. And so Jesus makes the application that as Christians, that is, as kingdom citizens, a simple yes or a simple no obligates us as much as the severest oath that we could make. And that was Jesus' point with what it was He was dealing with. However, it seems to me that he is not condemning any vow or oath, but emphasizing instead the need for truthfulness and honesty and reliability in all our dealings as Christians. Maybe we see this even more clearly in James chapter 5. James chapter 5 and verse 12. And when we get there, you're going to say, Reagan, I'm not sure this passage helps your point, but stay with me, okay? James chapter 5 and verse 12. In the context, he's talking about the importance of perseverance, of endurance, of patience, of following through, right? And he says, you need to do that with your vows as well. You need to follow through. But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment. Well, that's a specific condemnation, isn't it? Do not swear. But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or earth, so on and so forth. I would suggest that this is a great example of a not but construction. That is, an occasion where in, on this case, James is using a literary device to make a point, to emphasize the second of the two things that he is comparing. He's not actually prohibiting the former, but emphasizing the latter. You say, well, that sounds like preacher-ese to try and get around something, maybe. Well, let me give you an example that I think we can all agree on. 1 Peter chapter 3, just a few pages over in your Bibles. 1 Peter chapter 3, starting there in verse 3. New King James says, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Again, he has this, not this, but let it rather be this. And the translators of the New King James have tried to help us out. You'll notice that there are some words in italics that they have provided to give the sense of the text. But here's what it actually says in the Greek. Do not let your adornment be outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on apparel. So is Peter condemning on this occasion the wearing of clothes? He says, don't let your appearance be outward. Let not your adornment be outward. He says, don't put on apparel. Obviously, we understand what he's saying is, this is not where the focus is. You've got to put on clothes. You've got to fix your hair. You've got to do these natural things, but that's not where your focus is. Your focus needs to be on the hidden person of the heart. The text says, if we look at it with face value, that we don't wear clothes. But we understand that's not what Peter is saying. He's saying don't focus on the outside, focus on the inside. And likewise, Jesus and James are saying don't focus on making a vow or an oath to tell the truth. If you tell the truth, you tell it all the time. Your yes is yes and your no is no. And you don't have to take a vow for it to be truthful, for it to be truth that is coming from your lips. He's not condemning vows, I don't believe. He's just de-emphasizing them in a culture that had made only vows something that could be done for truthfulness. The only time truthfulness was expected was if there was a vow involved. So, maybe I haven't convinced you, but I believe that we can make vows or oaths, but I would still be very, very hesitant to do so. And so it is with great caution, then, that I ask the question, might there still be a place for vows in the life of a Christian? Covenants that we make, solemn vows to emphasize to us that this is what I am going to do. To emphasize to God and to others that this is what I am going to do. That just as God swore by Himself, though His yes is always yes and His no is always no, to emphasize to Abraham and by extension to us, the immutability of what it was he was going to do, might we also take a vow or swear an oath to emphasize the immutability of what it is we have determined to do. Notice two passages with me that illustrate what it is I have in mind. The first is found there in Job 31. Job was one of those examples of endurance. In fact, the example that James used just before talking about these oaths. And in Job 31, we find Job at perhaps his lowest point. And yet in all of this, he's holding on to his integrity. And he begins this chapter, which is the companion passage to Proverbs 31 and the worthy woman. This we might call the worthy man. Here is what a man ought to be. And he starts that in verse 1 of chapter 31 of the book of Job. He says, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? We should be familiar with that word covenant. And in essence, Job is saying that he has made a solemn vow, an oath, an agreement, not to look upon a young woman. And what's implied by the context, if we were to continue to read, is not to look at a woman in a lustful way. Was Job right to make that covenant with his eyes, to emphasize the immutability of what it is that he is going to do in this regard? I would say that he is justified in that. From our Bible reading in the book of Numbers, I want us to turn there for a moment. Numbers chapter 30. I apologize for the coughing, but I'm trying to do it away from the mic, if that helps. I've got one in my mouth already. It's not helping me very much, but thank you. It just sounds like I have rocks in my mouth. It's not keeping me from coughing. Numbers chapter 30, beginning in verse 1. Then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord, or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Or if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by some agreement while in her father's house in her youth. So now we're putting this in the context of a young woman still under the authority of her father. And her father hears her vow and the agreement by which she has bound herself. And her father holds his peace. Then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement with which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father overrules her on the day that he hears, then none of her vows nor her agreements by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will release her because her father overruled her. Now, God's putting a mechanism in place here to protect us in our youth. He's saying, I understand that you sometimes do foolish things in your youth. You make rash vows. And on this occasion, the father has the responsibility and the right to say, look, you don't understand what you're making in that vow. I'm going to release you from that. He says he has the authority from God in order to do that. But if he doesn't do that, then you're bound to keep it, whether it's rash or not. And he goes on to speak of a husband and wife in somewhat similar terms. So with these two passages in mind, I have three suggestions for you this morning. I'm not going to tell you what to do this morning. But I do want to make three suggestions. And this is where things really get dicey, I guess. The first suggestion is to the teenagers. Notice I say to the teenagers and not to their parents specifically, but parents, you are involved in this. There's a question that I was asked several months ago by a preacher. He didn't ask it specifically to me, but he sent out a message to a number of different preachers. It wasn't public knowledge that anybody could consume. And he said that he was asking specifically those who had maintained their purity before marriage. He says, I failed in that, and I want to know how you succeeded. I thought about that for a long time. Because I maintained my purity before marriage. And I'll be honest, there isn't anything particularly extraordinary about me when it comes to resisting temptation. I've given in to lots of other temptations that are much smaller, quote-unquote, less tempting, quote unquote. Why didn't I give in to that? Well, I've heard the accusation before. Well, you're a preacher. You don't understand what we're going through in terms of temptation. Being a preacher doesn't shield me from temptation. And I wasn't a preacher back then. But I was still a man back then. I was blessed with good teaching. And I thought about that for a while. You know, I had good Bible teaching, and I'm sure that made a difference, for sure. There are lots of others who had good teaching who give in to that temptation. I was blessed with a great family. Parents who loved me, parents who loved God, parents who wanted me to love God. But there are lots of people with good family who give in to that temptation. I only dated Christian girls. Christian in parentheses, or quotation marks. I came to find out in my dating life that sometimes that label doesn't mean a whole lot in the midst of temptation. I had opportunity. I had desire, which means I was tempted, but I didn't give in to the temptation. Why? Why not this? I thought about that for a long time, and I prayed about it. And I've decided it was very, very simple when you get right down to it. I decided long before I was in any of those situations. In fact, even before I fully understood what it was that I was deciding, that I wasn't going to do that before marriage. And I prayed to God, and I told God that I was not going to do that before marriage. I made up my mind long before I was in the heat of the moment. I made up my mind long before the temptation. And I told God that's what I was going to do. And so in the midst of temptation, sure, I was tempted, but I was never really tempted to do it. Mike Penn and I talked about this at length. And Mike is an extraordinary man to me in a lot of ways. And he said the same thing to me when we were discussing this passage here in Numbers and this particular issue. He said he had opportunities, but he had decided and he had vowed long before he was married that he wasn't going to engage in that activity outside of marriage. And he said, you know what? It wasn't really that big of a temptation because I'd already decided I wasn't going to do that. And I had vowed to God I wasn't going to do that. So to the teenagers, here is what I'm asking you to consider. I want you to consider making a solemn vow, a solemn oath, that from this day forward, you will not have sex outside of the marriage relationship. To the parents, I realize that my girls are 5 and 2, and I realize the awkwardness of this conversation, but I want you to broach this subject with your children. Broach this subject with your teenagers, especially those who are old enough to begin being tempted, and I would say that they begin being tempted earlier than we might remember. Parents, I want you to broach the subject with them. Tell them, if you want to, just like what we see here in Numbers chapter 30, I will listen to your vow, I will listen to your solemn oath, and you can make it to God before me in my presence. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying put pressure on them to make them do this, because that kind of defeats the whole point. But I do want you to have an honest conversation with them about this very thing. Because this is not some impossible task that we've been given because of hormones and everything else. God has given us the tools to overcome temptation. This one or any one. So to the teenagers, that's my suggestion to you. To spouses, to the married, my suggestion to you is to make a vow that from this day forward, you will not look on a man or woman, obviously who's not your spouse, with lustful intent. Now, whether that's pornography or whether that's just some random person at the ball field, you will not look at someone with lustful intent. Now, when I say to the married, obviously teens are not excluded in this, and neither are the unmarried who might be older. But I address this specifically to the married because in my short life and short experience with this, even among Christians, I have seen too many marriages destroyed by what begins as a seemingly innocent glance, but that glance later turns to a look, and that look turns into a thought, and that thought turns into a stare, and someday that stare turns into a touch. And homes are wrecked, lives are wrecked, souls are wrecked, because we look with lustful intent. And maybe the response is that, what, never? Never again? Never is a long time. Yes, never. Never again. And the immutability of what it is that I'm committing myself to do is known by God and is known by my spouse. That I will not do this again. And then finally, to all of us, to everyone, from this day forward, I vow that I will not do anything just because there is social pressure to do so. Worldliness is one of those things that just creeps in to our lives. It creeps in small and seemingly innocent sorts of ways. That we have social pressure to do things. That we have peer pressure, whether it's from a coworker or a friend or a family or a boss, to do certain things. And oftentimes the things that we are pressured to do are not sinful in and of themselves, are not inherently so. But as soon as we start making decisions based merely on the fact that this is what society expects of me, this is what my peers expect of me, it leads us down all sorts of roads where we should not go. Social pressure is close. Social pressure is immediate. We feel it now. We feel it in our stomach. We feel it on the nap of our neck. But usually, honestly, social pressure is short-lived and quickly forgotten. But it causes us to do all sorts of different things. I've told you before, I haven't mellowed a whole lot. At 31, almost 32, I'm getting on up there, right? I haven't mellowed a whole lot. But I do see a couple places in my life where maybe there's hope. Maybe I'm going to. And this is one of those areas. I don't always see things as black and white as I did when I was a little younger, like last year. And I'm sure some of that will continue as I get older, as I gain more experience. And I've prayed a lot about this, thought a lot about this. I want to address a specific subject in that regard. And that's prom. Don't close your ears, please. Hear me out. The issue is not, nor has it ever been, that prom in and of itself is a place where things take place that don't take place other places. We know anything that might happen at prom or after prom can and does take place other places at other times, and much, much worse takes place. And I am willing to concede that you can, under certain circumstances, attend prom and not be sinful to do so. That's difficult for me. It's not the way I was raised, not what I thought for a long time. That's difficult for me to concede. But here's what it is I really want to focus on as we think about this last vow or oath. Sometimes what's asked of me on this, and I see this a lot, it's not just with me. I see it online when articles are posted, and it's made me think, maybe I'm the one who's off. Maybe I'm the one who is out of touch. Maybe I'm the one who doesn't get it. Because I see things posted, and usually it's some preacher, right? Some preacher And then people come back with all of these other arguments as to why this is okay. But what I'm asked a lot is something along the lines of, let's just agree to disagree on this. And what's really being asked, whether it's in those words or not, is let's just leave this as a matter of judgment and consider this a matter of judgment, not of right and wrong. And I say this morning I'm willing to concede this as a matter of judgment under certain circumstances. Not that you need my concession. It's between you and God. But we can disagree on all sorts of different things as long as we are all prayerful and thoughtful and making our decisions based on what the Bible says instead of allowing the world to make our decisions for us. And we have to be so careful not to allow our society and the expectations of the society around us to make that decision, whether it's right or wrong, before it is prayerfully and thoughtfully and biblically considered. What does God say about this? What are God's directions on this particular topic? One final passage and to consider in the lesson this morning. That's Colossians chapter 3. I was studying this for our high school class this morning. Colossians 3, I mean. That kind of sounded wrong. I was studying this morning. I was studying this for the high school class this morning. And this is really what it's all about. If then, Colossians 3 and verse 1, if then, building on everything that he said in the book of Colossians, if then you were raised with Christ, if you have been saved through Christ and by Christ, if you have been forgiven of your sins, if you are a new man or woman in Christ Jesus, seek those things which are above, where Christ is sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth, for you died. Your old man, who you were, your old desires and passions, your will. You died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, you will also appear with Him in glory. Seek those things which are above. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. And in other words, it's not just about what we think about. It's where our focus is. It's where our treasure is. It's where our heart is. It's where our destination in life is. That what we seek, that where we set our mind and our will is always on things above. And that is what I'm asking every one of us to do in our decision making. That we will vow from this day forward, I will not do anything just because there is social pressure, physical pressure for me to do so. Because 1 year from now, it won't matter one bit to anyone that you didn't go to prom. All of those pressures and people who are pressuring you into that. 1 week from now, it won't matter one bit to anyone that you didn't laugh at somebody's dirty joke that everybody else was laughing at. 6 months from now, it won't matter one bit to those people on that team that go in and out that you have this short-term commitment to, that you weren't there to play that baseball game on Sunday morning and miss services. 5 years from now, it's not going to matter to anyone at the office that you didn't go to that riotous office drinking party for whatever the occasion might be. 10 years from now, it's certainly not going to matter that your shorts or your dresses were longer than everybody else's, that your pants weren't as tight as the style might be at this time. All of those social things that frankly we heap upon ourselves, those things will not matter unless we allow them to cause us to compromise what we know is right, to be conformed to the world instead of being conformed to the image of the Son. and 10,000 years from now, nothing else will matter to anyone, anywhere, except this. Are you right with God? If the world has ended and the Lord has come again, that's the only thing that's going to matter. Are you right with God? And perhaps these suggestions can help us to do just that. Social pressure doesn't always have to be bad. Sometimes it can be good. And this morning is an example of just that. You have in this room hundreds who have put Christ on in baptism, who have come saying, I've died to self and I live to Christ. And it is a wonderful and awesome commitment, a covenant that we make between us and God through Jesus Christ with all of the blessings that God showers upon us, not just in this life, but in the next. And if you're subject to that gospel call this morning, won't you come while together we stand while we sing. When we walk with the